ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Looking at your finances more closely this tax time? On the ABC Business Daily podcast, we break down the stories shaping employment and the economy. And as the financial year comes to a close, we're breaking down what you need to know in a special tax series. Hear it now. Search ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Ngunnawal country here in Parliament House, Canberra, with a croaky voice.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And PK, croaky, why? Let me guess. Last night was a midwinter ball, right? How was your night?
Look, wild and also unwild, both at the same time. I had a great night. Obviously, the parliamentary ball is kind of, you know, really important on the parliamentary kind of calendar for the year. Everyone gets dressed up. They make a lot of money for charity. You get the off-the-record speeches by the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. They're always very interesting. Sometimes they leak, sometimes they don't. If you're in the room, you're not meant to say what's in them, so don't ask because I don't want to not get invited again.
I was just going to ask.
I'll give you a report card and then we can bring Anna in because she
all
was
right.
there too.
All right.
See,
all right.
Let's like get her in trouble, not me.
All right.
But I think it's fair to say the Prime Minister's speech was, I've heard a lot of the Prime Minister's speeches. It was good. It was good. Solid job, but it wasn't like I'm falling off my chair. Angus Taylor's, look, I can see a lot of room for improvement. And I'm not criticising his delivery or something. It's not me being mean about him. I think the speech was, I've seen better opposition leader speeches. There was too much, if I can be broad about it, criticism of the government rather than criticism of oneself. And the funny ones are always self-deprecating. There wasn't enough self-deprecating. That's
all. The more gags, the better, really. The more, I get it. Laugh at yourself. It's not all about politics. And what happens at the midwinter ball stays at the midwinter ball, apparently. So I'm betting, this is my bet, that Labor had a better night, though, PK, because, you know, let's face it, Labor started the week with a spring in their step. Then there were three major polls putting them back on top as the preferred party after One Nation dipped a bit. One Nation support, though, it must be said, is still very high, still streets ahead of the coalition in some of them. We'll get into that. But PK, the PM, I notice, is going to press his luck here. The government's just introduced their gambling ads into the House, taking a punt that the coalition might cave and agree to pass these before the break. But I think that's unlikely, right?
It's obviously going to get kicked off to a committee. The other issues are housing has really, really dominated this week. Low auction clearance rates, again, proved pretty tricky for Labor. The opposition peppering the housing minister and the prime minister with questions on housing and the concerns around, you know, basically house prices. And then coalition chaos continued again. Angus Taylor's woes continued, of course, beyond the polls too. Frontbencher Melissa McIntosh doubling down on her call for a Liberal rebrand. And then such a backlash from people like, you know, Tony Abbott to her comments, calling, what was it, a brain fart it was referred to, which I can tell you a lot of people are thinking, oh, that's rather intriguing use of language. Lots to talk about. Let's bring her in. Anna Henderson is the Chief Political Correspondent at SBS. Anna, welcome to the Party Room.
What a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. I'm trying to keep my voice in check as well. I mean, the thing is, it's just very loud in there. You're trying to have conversations with people, but at the same time, the noise is just quite intense. So I could feel my vocal cords at the end of the night starting to fray a little bit. I appreciate the people who offered me, you know, some kind of additional support this morning around making sure that I could appear on this podcast.
And the later it gets, the louder it gets, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's holding out. So I'm pleased to be here.
Well, I have to say, telling everyone, I know we're not meant to focus on a woman and her clothing, but honestly, you look sensational in that green velvet suit.
I've heard that she was Crikey's best dressed.
No, really?
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. I've heard through the grapevine there's some kind of plan afoot.
She deserves the prize.
It was stunning. I am envious. Anyway.
There was velvet everywhere. In fact, I was wearing velvet and I sat down and then the napkin was velvet.
Oh.
I was like, I'm really in the velveteen mode here. Like, where do I end and the table begins? But anyway.
You are the it girl. You're right with the zeitgeist.
So good.
Anna, there have been 5 polls this week, including 3 big ones, all showing Labor regaining support. The One Nation vote dipping slightly. Labor is back as the most popular political party in all but one of those polls. These kicked off what's been another, I think, pretty successful week in terms of governing for Labor, dominating the political agenda, passing some of those key budget measures. Be that as it may, and we'll talk about some of that, Anna, but the One Nation dip, there's been a lot of talk about it. It's still within the margin of error. I think we should have a bit of a reality check here. Mm-hmm. Importantly, One Nation remains above the coalition, in some cases by a good distance. What do you read into the falling support for One Nation? Is it a response simply, you know, out and out to Pauline Hanson's first major outing at the National Press Club a fortnight or so ago, closer scrutiny on her policy ideas and inconsistency? Or, you know, what's going on here and who should be worried? One Nation, the government, or the coalition?
Or all of them.
So I had a chat with Sean Ratcliffe from Accent Research. He's involved with Redbridge in putting together the poll in the AFR, one of the first to track a within the margin of error dip in One Nation support, putting Labor back ahead. So psychologically, that's put a big spring in the government's step. Sean was telling me they didn't actually test directly what contributed to voter sentiment, but at the same time, they asked voters, what's the biggest news story for you in the last week when they were doing this polling process? And One Nation was far and away the biggest news story in politics that people identified. And then they went a little bit deeper and people talked about concerns about One Nation's position on paid parental leave and also multicultural discussion versus the monoculture call that Pauline Hanson has made. So I thought that was really interesting. Those things did cut through. Pauline Hanson has tried to tidy up her position on paid parental leave and say that she's not against it, but she's against small businesses having to pay more. But these issues did cut through. The government capitalised on them really quickly, making sure that it went on social media to kind of question where One Nation stood on paid parental leave. And it's obviously been quite successful. But there are very different kind of readings of these polls. From a One Nation point of view, they think it might be just a blip, and there's still strong views within One Nation that they could get their support up into the low 30s or early 40s. And they've got a strategy in place. It's a bit of a long game. But then when I speak to people, I guess hardheads within the Labor movement who've been looking at these numbers, they're very excited about these figures, and they do think that we're going to see a diminution of the support for One Nation. This is the beginning of a dropping off. They don't think it's going to be significant. Mm. Like, they still think there's going to be a significant proportion of the community that sticks with them. But, you know, they think that maybe it's peaked. It's very hard to tell at this point. There's a lot of things that could happen going forward. But the Liberal Party is certainly in absolute dire straits right now. Like, internally, when they look at these numbers, some polls putting them at sort of 17% on the primary, you know, it piles so much pressure on Angus Taylor when he's already had questions about his performance internally. And I think, you know, this sort of existential crisis, like when they look at where the Greens are at now and where the Liberal Party's at and the small amount of space between them, it's causing a lot of angst and a lot of questions about performance. But at the same time, we are years out from the next election. And I know there are a lot of people who get extremely frustrated by the focus on the polls. I think it's right for us to look at them at this point in the cycle, given how big One Nation support base has become. And also,
so quickly.
Yeah. And also, like, the questions that are being raised, and we know that political parties do look at these polls to work out, are we going in the right direction policy-wise or leadership-wise? But I also acknowledge there are those people who think there's far too much focus on the polls. But I do think they're a test of whether policies and personalities are hitting the mark.
Yeah, I mean, you know, polls, I agree, you've got to be careful around this time. But, you know, they are literally an indication of how the public feels. Mm-hmm. as well. And the biggest, most important figure, I think, hands down, is that figure in the Redbridge polling, which we've talked about before, but I just want to get your thoughts on, which is not, you know, that so many Australians don't like the direction the country is going in.
Mm.
And that's the sentiment stuff that should be alarming. It doesn't matter if Labor's come back a bit. That mean, of course, that's important for them psychologically.
Yeah.
And politics is a psychological game, as you and I know. But it's also, they should continue to be alarmed about that sentiment, because that's the one they have to turn around, isn't it?
That's the grievance and frustration. And far and away, it's about cost of living more than anything else. When people identify what they are worried about, it's their living standard and whether they feel like they are, you know, having a good and improving life for themselves and their families or not. And a lot of Australians right now really don't. The government has been trying to address that with things like, you know, the housing measures that they've put together. They're hoping that's a long game and that's a slow burn in terms of realisation in the community and some of their other policies as well. But, you know, when you look at those figures, it's extremely, I guess, concerning for the government, because whatever they're doing and however strongly they feel they are taking the country forward, it's just not reflecting in the community. One other thing that I did want to mention, which is, you know, not within the margin of error, it's not like a main indicator, but I think around Pauline Hanson's support, it's one that has got a lot of focus, which is that net approval rating. Because for her in the Redbridge poll, that dropped by 10 points in the week after the National Press Club address. So even though the other movements around primary vote were smaller, I think there was a big signal to the pollsters, at least, and to the political parties, that she lost quite a lot of bark out of that speech, and that, you know, that her personal approval dropped in a significant way. You don't usually see drops of that magnitude in the space of, you know, just a week. So I think it was worth pointing that out too.
Yeah, though I also want to point out that in the essential poll in The Guardian, I think it was, you know, I don't know that either of the major parties would be too comfortable about this. It found that 29% of people said they would definitely vote for One Nation. Okay, that's kind of in line with some of the polls. And a further 23% saying they'd be open to it, which is over 50% of voters in total. So I think that goes to that sentiment thing that you were talking about, PK. And also, yeah, I agree, Anna, far away it's about cost of living, but tied up in that very much is the question of immigration that's deeply entrenched in this vote for One Nation and the fading of the support for the major parties, that people are troubled by this. And it is tied up because they link it with the access to housing and renting and and a whole lot of things. I think it remains difficult for the government. But talking about housing, Anna, it's still taking up a lot of the oxygen around the place. It's definitely a trouble spot for the Albanese government as auction clearance rates are falling, keep falling. Cotality data showed this week that national home values were falling. 0.4% doesn't sound like much, but it's the biggest monthly decline since December 2022. People are a bit spooked. The RBA has talked about this, especially first home buyers. The Prime Minister and the Treasurer, you know, they can point to their Treasury forecasts all they like, that housing growth, you know, will continue to grow but more slowly.
And so overall, we expect prices to continue to grow more slowly. There is a bit of volatility in house prices. There is a bit of volatility in auction clearance rates. These are long-term investments. But different market forecasts have said different things about this. The Treasury assumptions are pretty clear, and they're a national assumption rather than specifically about Sydney or Melbourne on its own.
But it's difficult to predict how this sentiment shift, again, we're talking sentiment, will impact the housing market, the general economy, and the support for the government.
Like, Labor's very confident that their policy is going to hit over time and that the Treasury figures, which said, you know, housing growth would slow by 2%. So, you know, overall that there'd still be continued housing growth in terms of valuations and prices, but that it would just grow more slowly. But at the same time, like, I can tell you there is a sense of concern and amongst some quarters, like a bit of panic around just how steep some of these drops have been in some parts of the country, because this is for
Melbourne
many
and
Australians,
Sydney for a start.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's for many Australians, their kind of key asset. And, you know, it's, you know, the biggest outlay they'll ever make in their lives. And it's kind of tied to their standard of living and what else they can do, you know, with their time. And there's a lot of people who want to potentially remortgage and do more on their houses. All of this is tied up in, you know, their quality of life. And so there is, you know, a scare around this, and people are a bit fearful about what it means, particularly if they've just forked out and then discovered that their house is likely to have a lower valuation very quickly. So Jim Chalmers, as Treasurer, is saying, you know, you've got to play the long game here. Most people aren't buying and selling a house within a matter of years. This is, for many people, a, you know, many decades long decision. But I think there is concern within the government about how this is going to end up landing. There's a lot of things that they're forecasting and relying upon, but those forecasts need to actually come true. And so, you know, that's where the opposition has been trying to capitalise in Parliament by sort of forcing them into a corner to say, you know, how many people on first home buyer grants have now potentially immediately lost value on their purchase.
My question is to the Minister for Housing. Labor's correction in house prices means the value of an Australian home could collapse by 10 to 20%. Smashing Australia's nest egg. Did the Minister receive or review any advice from Treasury or APRA about how many first home buyers will be pushed into negative equity because of Labor's deliberate correction?
I don't think they've landed really significant blows on that in Parliament, but you can see that's the direction they're going down. They think that will resonate.
Yeah, it's the first time I've seen them sort of try to do something. They haven't got anywhere, but they're trying to mount this argument. Look, I think Labor has been strategic here in showing that they're holding their nerve, don't you reckon? And which, you know, there hasn't been, and I hate this political term, but I'm going to use it because it's so widely used in politics, but they haven't wet the bed. You know, like they haven't like, freaking out about the housing thing. They think prices will come back, you know, people will see the merits of it. And as one senior person said to me, which I thought was a really good point, I'd love to get your thoughts on it. Okay, now, absolutely, the next 6 months are going to be very hard for us, this person said, about Labor, and that's right. But then going into the next election cycle, is the coalition seriously going to go to an electorate, right, where there are so many young people on the electoral roll now? My daughter's going to be voting for the first time. Like, you know, I'm talking Gen Z, young ones, like are really going to be voting with a promise to reintroduce negative gearing, which has become such a sort of symbolic thing, back on housing. So you'd have to go in every press conference, if it's Angus Taylor or Andrew Hastie, say, we're going to put negative gearing back on your housing.
Yeah. You can't sort of
imagine it.
You
can't imagine it, can you?
But at the same time,
we're going to fight for your negative gearing back. Okay.
So the opposition, if they are in that position, which at this point that's the line they're taking, they will have to rely then on what they have so far held as their very strong view that aspirational Australia wins out over sort of let's have a level playing field Australia. They're thinking, and they've obviously got their own research they're leaning into for this as well, and possibly their own lobby groups as well in their ear encouraging them. But, you know, there's still a strong view within the Liberal Party that, you know, people want to have the aspirational right to do what the people before them did with raising capital, with, you know, their assets. So I guess we'll see where that lands. The government obviously is extremely confident that the long game will be in their favour here. So we'll
and
see.
The government should be able to argue that on the stats. Like the stats are pretty clear about who negative gearing helps and who it doesn't. So they should be able to knock that off. But it's all very well to say play the long game. But I wonder whether they're factoring in sort of sentiment, unconscious sentiment that's been built up in Australia over decades, that our housing, yes, it's our asset, it's our home, but it's more an asset than our home. It's our wealth. It signifies our wealth rather than just where we live. Mm. That's a shift. It's something that doesn't feature so largely in other countries, I think. And if people are feeling less wealthy, that's a really negative sentiment for a government to counter. And it's quite an easy sentiment for opposition politicians, whether it's One Nation, the Greens or the Coalition, to sort of stir up resentment over, I think. And that's kind of what we're seeing, this negative sentiment the RBA talked about. Yes, interest rates have had an impact. High house prices that have been building for years have had an impact on the market, but so has the government's tax changes, even though in theory they really shouldn't have had much impact yet, but they have. It's all about sort of risk and security and positive sentiment about how well off you are or aren't, isn't it?
So one thing I noticed on the flip side of that, at the last election, was how much support there was, and it's a different policy, but how much support there was for the government to help out with HECS debt for young people intergenerationally between families. There was just this sense that even though it would cost the budget, even though it doesn't help me personally, like, I'd like to see my kids and grandkids actually get ahead. So I think the government is really counting on that intergenerational sympathy on this front to win out over that expectation of wealth in the family home. But, you know, it's just been so entrenched for so long.
Mm, it really has.
That's the quandary.
All right. So let's pivot to big story this week. And we're recording this Thursday as we do. It's playing out right now. 3 years after that landmark Peter Murphy report was handed down, Labor is finally introducing its long-awaited gambling ad reform.
This bill will introduce a meaningful and impactful suite of reforms to protect Australians, particularly children and young people, from gambling harms. It will help minimise children's exposure to wagering advertising while also reducing the overall saturation of advertising on radio and television and the targeting and saturation of advertising online. The reason is clear. Gambling advertising restrictions have not kept pace with community expectations.
But it's rather friendless, as it's been described, I think, by my colleague David Spears. Friendless piece of legislation. So words like capitulation, half-assed, it's gone on, have been used by the Greens, by the Liberals.
I particularly liked milksop.
I particularly liked
some of the gambling, anti-gambling T-shirts that the Crossbench came out in this week with slogans like Bet Unfair and tab.com.au and Sports Debt. I thought they were pretty funny. Anyway, sorry.
They were not.
Sorry to interrupt, PK.
No, I'm glad you did.
Did they put it into, you know, Google Thesaurus, or is this all coming out of...
I think they put it into ChatGPT.
You can always hear the dot points and the bad sounds when they've been through AI. Sorry, I don't think it's up to it yet. I know it will be. But Anna, The Coalition now talking tough on this. Really? Are they going to push for much tougher regulation? Are they going to take on the big media companies that want these advertising dollars?
I think Peter Dutton, when he was opposition leader, started to get a sense that this was an issue that people care about in the community and that there was potentially more to be done. And, you know, we had the party room meeting from the opposition this week. There were Liberals who spoke up in that meeting who wanted to raise concerns about the Labor position. There were personal stories told, and we've heard some just absolutely shocking stories about how this works and how people get caught in the sort of chain of gambling addiction. So I put it this way, like, we're in a season where there's a lot of sport on television, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of families sitting down to watch sporting events together. And nothing, in my experience, seems to energise a lot of parents more than the fact that they do have to sit with their kids through this kind of advertising and what it, you know, means for them. So I feel like it does underscore the fact that in the community there's frustration around this issue. I think the Liberal Party is picking up on that. It's also true that, you know, there were a number of Liberal MPs who joined John Howard in an open letter calling for stronger gambling reform earlier this month as well. PK, on your show, Tim Wilson signalling the Coalition open to an inquiry. I think there's going to be an inquiry. Mm. I think there's going to be more looking at what's under the hood here and pressure on the government. And there is a view within the opposition that they can push the line that the government is in some way trying to find some middle ground that isn't tough enough because of the potential pressure they have from industry.
Yeah.
And I mean, just on the face of it, I'm not there. So I'm not seeing the lobbyists walking around like you are, you two are. But mm-hmm. Labor's putting up, you know, these changes, saying we heard the minister on Radio National Breakfast this morning. She was very insistent that their changes would make a real difference. So Labor's legislation would restrict broadcast to 3 gambling ads per hour between 6 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. That's alongside a complete ban during live sports broadcasts within those hours. And then it's a free-for-all. But Anna, it's not like the kids are going to stop watching sport and go to bed at 8:30 p.m. in the middle of a game or something. 3 gambling ads an hour, that's a lot, isn't it? To me, I think those parents you're talking about will hear that and go, well, that's no help. They're also going to phase in an ad ban for jerseys, ban sports stars from promoting gambling, tighter limits on radio ads in school pickup hours. But, you know, it just sounds a little limp to me.
Yeah, so it's that 3 an hour between 6 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. And I can give you a little update, actually. As we're going to air now in Parliament, Andrew Wilkie's speaking. He's obviously on the crossbench. He's been a long-term proponent of the need for significant change in this area. He's urging a conscience vote on this issue. And he's just said in Parliament, how can the Prime Minister sleep at night with the hundreds of gambling addicts who've committed suicide?
Calls on the Prime Minister to personally explain to the House and to all Australians why protecting gambling companies, media companies and major sporting codes is more important to him and his government than protecting the interests and the lives of Australians. Deputy Speaker, sadly, this is not my first rodeo. We've been here before and we've already seen into the heart of the Labor Party in Australia.
You know, this is an issue that is deeply personal for a number of politicians. They are lobbied by their electorates, and that includes Labor politicians as well.
So then I want to know why the government isn't going harder here. I mean, in terms of things they haven't picked up from the Murphy Inquiry, for instance, they haven't gone for a national regulator. I don't quite understand that. And they haven't gone for, you know, complete blackout of gambling ads during televised sport. They haven't gone for no end to inducements. I don't quite understand it. Is it about just out-and-out lobbying by powerful media interests? Is it about accepting a pitch from free-to-air television that they're struggling enough as it is, and if you do this, they're going to just, you know, fall out of contention altogether and disappear? The model is broken. Why is the Prime Minister standing so sort of strongly here behind some of these changes that both sides of politics are calling for now, including a lot within Labor's ranks? I mean, Mike Freelander, a Labor MP, says there is much more to be done. He says the bill's a good step, but he's been outspoken and others are outspoken on this.
Yeah, I just think it goes back to the original point you made, Fran, like about the sort of fierce lobbying, the sort of financial models of these companies. I think the government's tried to walk this line and, yeah, it might come back to bite them, because sometimes when you're appeasing them but you're also showing that you're doing some reform, well, you have no friends at the end, right? Like everyone's, you know, it's not good enough for anyone and you end up getting yourself into a pickle.
Okay, so the PM's going to run this. How will they give ground?
They'll give some ground. They have to give it some ground. I mean, like, that is the only way to get it through the parliament. I've always said, and I said this in the pod with David, I just think the coalition will talk tough and then capitulate a little bit. Sorry, like, they're getting lobbied by the same people.
Yeah, yeah. But they'll use all this intervening time to really put some pressure on. And, you know, Simon Kennedy, for example, on the Liberal side has been quite vocal on this front. And he's obviously out there. You know, the public will make a decision on what finally lands as to whether or not they think it goes far enough. But again, it's going to come down to that family on the couch and the call that they make about, like, are we prepared to cop this with our kids? Mm. Is it okay that our kids are seeing this?
Mm.
And that will be the deciding factor, I think.
Mm. And of course, one more point, you know, elections are won and lost on big themes and sentiments, right? These things like this end up going into the column of perhaps grievance, but they aren't vote switches apart from for small numbers of people. It's the economy, stupid always. So the government just would hope that they could ride it out. People will accept they've done something and move on. But if there are 1,000 cuts like this where people feel like not enough is being done, that's when it hurts.
They're not showing guts.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep. And the time frame, like how long this has gone on for without a resolution, is a problem for the government as well.
And I think, you know, the Prime Minister, it will be betting that the social media changes they brought, the age limits, will give them sort of cred with those same sort of families. So maybe that'll get them over it. Anna, we spoke about the polls earlier. The bigger narrative is that the coalition has failed to really, so far, capitalise on that dip in One Nation's vote. So they hit an historic low of 17 in news poll. And, you know, that was after last week's messy week for Angus Taylor, we've talked about, around multicultural and monoculturalism. But this week didn't start off too tidily either. I mean, it kicked off with frontbencher Melissa McIntosh telling Sky that the Liberal Party should consider a rebrand.
It's time for the Liberal Party to rebrand itself. Some people think that we're stuck in the past and our policies need to resonate with the Australia of today and the future. So I think it'd be a really good time for us to revisit our values, what we stand for and the way we project ourselves to Australians.
Now, she's copped a lot of flack from some of her her Liberal Party colleagues for that. But Anna, is really anything she said too contentious? I mean, or even original idea? They clearly need a revamp, if not a rebrand. And as Melissa McIntosh said in that interview, there's a perception that the Liberals and a lot of their policies are stuck in the past. I mean, that is hardly a radical thought, is it?
So given the context, when I heard Melissa McIntosh talking about that and talking about the potentially stuck in the past comments, it reminded me of things that others had raised with me over the past week or so from different factions within the Liberal Party, of concerns about Tony Abbott, actually, as Liberal Party president, coming back into quite an influential role in the party, and whether or not he was influencing the Liberal Party to kind of return to some of his policy positions when he was prime minister, and this sense that, you know, the Liberal Party needs to move forward. It needs to regenerate. It needs to have fresh ideas and not to feel like it's being dragged back to have to prosecute things that it no longer thinks necessarily resonate in the broader community or really specific kind of culture war issues. So whether or not she was specifically talking to that issue, there has been that discussion happening within the Liberal Party more broadly over the last week. And so, Melissa McIntosh, when she was saying this, was talking about and referencing the fact that the broadcaster she was on, Sky News, was changing its name. So I think there were some who were interpreting this, or perhaps in their criticism of her, saying, what, you want to change it from Liberal Party? But that's not what she was meaning.
That's what I thought. It's ridiculous.
It actually
hurt my brain. It's like she means the whole approach, the way that they're connecting, you know, with women.
Let's freshen up the brand, right?
She means what the report says that's been handed to them. They have a problem with multicultural communities. Women, have we forgotten all this? Have they forgotten all this? This is still there, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's been there for multiple electoral cycles.
Stuck in the past. That's what she said. She used those words, right?
Yeah, so I think she actually started a conversation, and she probably brought out into the open something that others have been quietly speaking about. But she herself, I know, has, you know, aspirations to move up in the Liberal Party too. I think she's put herself out there as somebody who is willing to engage in that conversation. And there are actually many, particularly Liberal women, not in the party necessarily, but in the broader kind of Liberal branch world, who are really keen to have that conversation too. Not just women, but I know, you know, I've spoken to a couple who were cheering her on for making that comment, even though it has caused them harm politically and it's been used as a weapon by the government during the week.
Yeah. But the pile on her, when at the same time senior coalition men routinely come on, I know, on my show, as I think is healthy, by the way. I think right now at 17%, they should be having this discussion.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't avoid having it publicly because we're all engaged in what's happened to this political party. Tim Wilson said, I know you're obsessed with what's happening to us. I said, yeah, you're one of our main political brands in this country. Of course, we should be. Like the Liberal and National parties have been governments for like the majority of our contemporary history, right? Mm. It is a big deal what's happening with
them. Compare that pylon to the reaction from within to the comments from Andrew Hastie. He gave a cracking interview to you on Afternoon Briefing this week, PK, and I didn't hear that being described as a brain fart.
Well, that's what I mean. That wasn't a brain fart, was it? So, you know, you can understand why people are going, hello, is it because she's, you know, a younger-ish, you know, but woman, is that why? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, there is a sense within the Liberal Party that there isn't a lot of discipline at the moment. I think the opposition leader made that clear behind closed doors this week, that he wanted to see everybody rowing in the same direction, or whatever words he used, and that he is frustrated by, you know, the backgrounding that's going on and the discussion that's going on about his leadership as well and where the Liberal Party is headed. But at the same time, you know, when you have those polling numbers, it is night follows day that you're going to have this discussion because there's going to be questions to be raised and some tough talk to be had around what's going wrong and what needs to change.
Yeah. And Andrew Hastie, you know, the interview he did with me has been, people are still talking about it like at the end of the week because, it's, you know, he's the sort of guy, he's not sort of a rent-a-quote when he speaks.
Yeah.
It matters. He's very strategic about his interventions and his messages about how to fight One Nation, about how to be really distinctive as a brand, not capitulate to One Nation, especially because he is a right-wing figure, has been quite meaningful.
You know, very strong line In a way that I think there's a frustration that leadership of the party hasn't taken in terms of let's take it to One Nation, let's try and construct an argument as to why we are different and why we are the better party to support, and also calling out from his perspective how the impact of One Nation kind of attacking him personally has gone to his family and has led to him having to have extra security advice and assistance. Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting interview. He also spoke about multiculturalism in that interview though, and he was, you know, not keen to necessarily run a really clear line about multiculturalism.
Well, he was against monoculturalism, Hanson, and he took that, as I said in the last pod, he attacked it from the right, using right-wing arguments attacking the idea of monoculture, that big government tells you what to do. I thought that was a powerful argument.
Well, let's take monoculture, for example. How do you police that? Do we want government more involved in our lives, policing who fits into Pauline Hanson's definition of Australian culture and who doesn't? How do you do that?
And he thinks now that multiculturalism is politically loaded. That's the term he used, right?
Well, monoculture and multicultural, they're two kind of... they're two extremes in a sense. I think we just have a strong civil society. We have people from different backgrounds. It doesn't matter what country you came from. It doesn't matter what
you're... We've used the term multicultural for a long time. Are you comfortable with it?
Sure. Well, it's now a loaded political term.
Now, I think what he's saying, and this is my analysis, not what he said, I want to be clear about that, but basically now that it's become a culture war, because Hanson made it that, right, it's become that, and, you know, that it's almost seen as a concept of the left. Now, I've got to say, historically, that's not right. Like, the Liberals and Labor have always had the bipartisan multicultural policy. But as right-wing politics around the world has changed, and if you look at big discussions about immigration, multiculturalism in other countries, including the UK, it has become more contested. I mean, it's indisputable that things have changed. And I think that's what he's talking about. He's trying to walk a middle path. I don't know if he's landed that quite. I didn't feel like it was fully landed, but I get what he's trying to do.
Because he gave this sense in the interview that multiculturalism and monoculturalism were sort of extremes of the same conversation. He then left the studio and he spoke to other reporters, and he immediately kind of reframed what he said to be more about, you know, I'm not saying it's extreme to back multiculturalism. So I thought it was interesting because it does tie into what Angus Taylor got tied up in as well, which is, you know, when Angus Taylor wanted to explain his position after that press conference, he too was saying he was concerned that multiculturalism was becoming a concept of the left and that he wanted to make sure that it didn't get redefined in a way that the Liberal Party didn't agree with.
You know, there's one way to do that, basically take it and reassert it as a bipartisan position and the basis of modern Australia. Anna, just before you go, Parliament rises tonight for the long winter break. Politicians won't be back in Canberra until August. I'm noticing a bit of housekeeping going on. I think John Howard used to call it scraping off the barnacles. One of them, the changes announced today to the aged care tool assessment, which is part of the government's recent aged care revamp, copping some flack, not unjustly, I think. It's all about, you know, an AI algorithm, which will be assessing where people, what level they qualify for of help under the aged care system. And that's going to now be adjusted to allow, quote, human intervention in extenuating circumstances, which is what people are saying. You can't just leave this to AI. If people say it's made the wrong decision, you've got to be able to have a review. So there's that sort of thing going on. It's all about government keeping a laser focus on the issues they want to be talking about. In this case, it's Anthony Albanese wants to talk about building more houses, making houses more affordable for first home buyers, making the tax system fairer. The government has still got a lot of work to do around a lot of big questions. So how do you think the PM and his cabinet, not to mention Angus Taylor and his shadow cabinet, will be spending the winter break, do you reckon? On holiday in Europe somewhere or in deep policy mode? What's your hunch?
Well, there are a few packing their bags, that's for sure, and taking some time off, as you know, everyone in the country is allowed to do, take a holiday. But I think there is a strong message going out that this is not a time to take the foot off the pedal
no.
and that people need to be out there. This is on all fronts, including One Nation as well, need to be out there campaigning, need to be out there talking to people, need to be out there getting prepared for the next period. For Labor, they've also got the Labor National Conference in the break, which is, you know, a huge, I guess, policy discussion point for them and can be beset with issues if the rank and file don't agree with where the government is. Like, there's a lot of work going into sort of corralling the different parts of that conference process and trying to keep everyone, I guess, on the straight and narrow in terms of how that will flow. It is an important moment and it is a time when things bubble up to the surface. I think the Liberal Party, like, there is enormous pressure. It's not pressure that Angus Taylor is about to face a leadership contest necessarily at all, though things can change. But there is pressure to try and deal with the diminution of their support. And, you know, every poll will be closely watched over this period. So I expect that we will not be without significant work to do as journalists.
I think that's right. Have to get your final thoughts on the midwinter ball. Other than you looking good and all of us taking appropriate photos.
You look great too, Pika. I've seen the photos.
Did.
Come on.
All right, sure. You can see my photos on my Instagram. Tell me, though, what did you make of the speeches? Yes, they're off the record. We're not going to tell them the content, but the vibes of the room.
The vibes of the room, I think there was, you know, there were a few cheers and some claps and laughs during the process of the leader of the country delivering his roast, as it is. When the opposition leader got up and had his attempt, I think that it didn't land on a number of fronts. And I think, you know, chatting to a few of his colleagues about it, it's off the record and it's a kind of discussion that isn't necessarily publicised, but it wasn't the kind of circuit breaker on that night that they were hoping for.
Yeah.
That was very diplomatically
put, Anna. Sometimes
you will be on the invite list next year.
Sometimes you just got to spend a bit more time working on your speech.
Yeah, and maybe there's a sense that, you know, part of this process is how you can reflect on yourself and your party as well as others, and that's considered an important part of having a laugh in that moment, that other leaders have managed to, you know, straddle that process in the past a little better.
Yeah. Beautifully said.
Sometimes it's hard to get a joke out, though, when you're not feeling too.
And you're not a comedian. I mean, it's a tricky thing, right? You're a political leader. You're not a comedian. I mean, you know, if you're a funny guy, that's just extra luck for you. That's it for the Party Room today. We'll be back for a Question Time edition tomorrow. Keep sending your questions in. We love answering them. Send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, and it's great to have you with us always. Thank you. David Spears will be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday. And then Mel is in the hot seat with Politics Now for the next few days early in the week.
That's right. And remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. See you, Anna.
Okay, I'm going to go rest my voice. So I look forward to chatting to you guys soon. Thanks for having me.
See you, Anna. Thanks.
See you, Fran.
See you, PK.